Hey everyone, it's me, Reed Galen. As you may have noticed, I don't host the Lincoln Project podcast anymore, but I'm so excited to share with you my brand new show, The Homefront. On The Homefront, you'll get the same incisive discourse about the pro-democracy movement from the smartest, most driven people in the fight today. If you're listening to this episode on the Lincoln Project podcast channel, I invite you to subscribe to The Homefront on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your shows. I want to say thank you to all of you in the pro-democracy movement, and I look forward to continuing our American journey together. And now, The Homefront. Welcome to The Homefront. I'm your host, Reed Galen. Today, I'm joined by political commentator and creator, Brian Tyler Cohen. He's the host of the No Lie with Brian Tyler Cohen podcast, an MSNBC contributor, and has a very successful YouTube channel with over 3 million subscribers. I'm just a hair behind you there, Brian. He's got a new book. It was a number one New York Times bestseller. It's called Shameless. It was out last month. Republicans' Deliberate Dysfunction and the Battle to Preserve Democracy, which is now available wherever fine books are sold. Today, he is coming to us from beautiful, sunny California. Brian, welcome.
Reed, thanks so much for having me. Excited to do this.
All right, so let's start with the book. It is the idea, as we talked about just beforehand, that Republicans still use the branding and the top line messaging of a party that existed when I was a Republican as both a kid and a campaign guy. So tell us a little bit about, are you just expressing and illustrating for your readers what it is that means? Are you giving any advice to, say, the Democratic Party and how they operate? What were you hoping to achieve by writing this book and making sure people know this? Because my former Lincoln Project cohort, Stuart Stevens, wrote a book very similar called It Was All a Lie.
Yeah, I mean, it's an all of the above strategy, right? It's to expose this veneer of what Republicans pretend to be and what they're simultaneously using right now to help them in the election that we're currently heading toward. I mean, right now, Republicans are still kind of benefiting from their historical branding as they continue to present themselves as some responsible stewards of the economy. Even though you can look at the Trump administration versus the Biden administration, you can see how the Trump administration lost 3 million jobs, saw an economic contraction of 3.5%, left office with a 6.3% unemployment rate. It was a dismal economic showing. And meanwhile, we have a Democratic administration in office right now that's overseeing the addition of 16 million jobs, a 50-year low in unemployment, the strongest economy on the face of the earth, and a record high stock market. But still this idea that Republicans are somehow more responsible in terms of stewardship of the economy persists. And so my goal is to finally try and help debunk for as many people as I can do it with to debunk some of these myths that Republicans kind of skate by on top of while in reality actually doing nothing to help the economy, doing nothing to protect the idea of states' rights, doing nothing to protect the Constitution, law and order, family values, whatever it is that they're still pretending to benefit from.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. The one thing that, as I mentioned to you right before we started taping, I was in London last night, and I was on a panel where Mehdi Hasan was debating a Trump guy. And the guy, to your point, was just kept going, there were 4 years of peace and prosperity under Donald Trump. And he kept repeating it. And finally, you know, Mehdi comes to the panel I was on. And he's like, well, what do you guys think about this? I'm like, it's not true. Aside from all the economic facts you noted, Brian, like, 750,000 Americans died because of his incompetence.
Right.
Right. And it's one of those things where, you know, and throughout the hour and a half that we were there, you're right. Like, they lean back on all of this stuff that when I was a kid, right, there were three very simple stools of the Republican Party, at least, you know, from a messaging branding perspective, you know, individual liberty, a moral and muscular foreign policy, and, you know, fiscal responsibility. And that wrapped up all of the business and stuff that you're talking about. But the funny thing is that none of those three legs of the stool are left anymore. To your point, like, states' rights, convenient when it works for them.
And by the way, they all backed that Texas 2020 lawsuit seeking to invalidate the election results in four other states because they didn't like the outcome there.
Right, exactly. And then, you know, I mean, look, the idea of the overturn of Roe v. Wade, and this is the difference, I think, as I've noted on other shows, that Republicans fight on values and Democrats tend to fight on issues. And I think that Democrats have plenty of value-based propositions with which they should fight. But one of the things that we've seen that works a little bit with soft Republicans, especially men, have a couple of girls like I do, is that giving it back to the states is not really a states' right thing. It's a massive centralized control just at the state level rather than at the federal level. And then there's this whole idea, you know, just staying with the judiciary for a second, of originalism, but it's really originalism whenever it works for them. And it's not whenever they want to come up with something out of whole cloth, let's say like this immunity decision they came up with last summer.
Right. And I think the thing, too, is they kind of got out in front of they got out over their skis a little bit, because as soon as they purported to claim that they want this to be a state's issue as far as reproductive rights are concerned, what happened in the House and the Senate, there were lawmakers and senators who introduced nationwide abortion bans. Lindsey Graham himself has not only introduced one of those, but came out and said that we'll probably see something along the lines of a 12 to 16 week abortion ban. So they couldn't even give themselves plausible deniability long enough to get past this election before they already started giving the game away in terms of what they actually want here.
Yeah, and I think it was earlier this year, or maybe late last year, the Alabama Supreme Court basically invalidated IVF down there. All the Republicans go running for the hills because even Trump knew this was bad news. Then the Democrats, I think in a very smart show of legislative prowess, put a bill guaranteeing right to IVF up on the floor of the U.S. Senate, and the Republicans kill it, right? Because they're stuck between a rock and a hard place, which is they're stuck between knowing that like this is unpopular with moderate voters, but also knowing that it means a lot to their base evangelical voters. And so here they are stuck. And then you've got Rick Scott running ads in Florida for his flailing U.S. Senate campaign saying, no, he supports IVF. And so I think the point that your book, and I hope to read it soon, makes also is that not only do they not believe any of this stuff, but the stuff that is patently unpopular, they have to bob and weave every which way to try and get out of it. And frankly, if there were more than two nationally, you know, recognized and successful political parties, the Republican Party would be in a free fall right now.
Right. And I think that it's incumbent upon the Democrats to do what would happen if we did have more of a parliamentary system, which is to make overtures to soft Republicans. And to Kamala Harris and Tim Walz's credit, that's exactly what they're doing. You wouldn't have, look, if this race was really about making sure to shore up the left flank, you would not have Kamala Harris and Tim Walz going out there with camo hats, advocating for, you know, protecting the most basic Second Amendment protections, even though clearly there are common sense gun safety measures that they still support, reclaiming this idea of freedom. They wouldn't be doing that. These are straight overtures to the middle. And that's to their credit, to Donald Trump's disadvantage, because he's physically incapable. He doesn't know how to make overtures to anybody in the middle, because the prospect of the instant gratification of getting his base to clap for him when he throws them red meat is just so irresistible for this guy. His ego is so delicate and fragile that if he can just say the most base thing to his, you know, most diehard supporters and they can clap for him for a few seconds, that is clearly more valuable to him than saying something that might be just 5% less popular, but that might appeal to people in the middle. He can't do it. The value of that adulation from his audience is just too irresistible to Donald Trump. And so instead, he's left in a situation where all he can bring himself to do is continue making overtures to just the farthest right fringes of his base.
Well, and it's a double-edged sword. That adulation is also his ground game, for lack of a better way to put it. They are the people who turn out in droves. And you said 5%. I think 5% matters, because when he waffled on Amendment 4 down in Florida that would overturn the 6-week abortion ban that Ron DeSantis signed, when he said he thought that he'd vote for it, the evangelicals went nuts on social media. They said, we knew he was never with us. You know, we should find somebody who's true to our belief system, et cetera, et cetera. And so he needs the adulation, but he also needs the votes. But again, every time he goes deeper and deeper into the darkness, which they always do, Vance does the same thing, more and more otherwise normal, moderate, middle-of-the-road voters say, I want nothing to do with this.
Right, which is why, by the way, Republicans have lost elections in these midterm cycles in Kentucky and Kansas and Ohio and Alabama, all of these big blue liberal bastions, right? Like, that just goes to show how toxic this issue is. But to your exact point, they are between a rock and a hard place, because they have to balance two completely contradictory factions of the electorate here, which is their base and the much more moderate, reasonable center. And they don't know how to juggle both without seeming completely disingenuous.
Well, and, you know, it's interesting. So one of the guys I was on a panel with last night, he was a younger guy. He represents Trump supporters abroad. And he said this to me. He said, quote, "We killed that, my old party, and we're proud of it." And so this is the other part, too, about what your book, I think, represents is not only do they lay back on a brand that really no longer exists, there's a whole generation of new Republican voters, I think mostly young white guys, who don't believe in anything the old party believed in. They don't believe in any of this stuff. They do believe in centralized control. They are not fans of democracy. They are not fans of a United States that helps keep the world order in place. They're not huge fans of NATO. They don't believe we should help Ukraine. And they're for all of this stuff that is authoritarian in nature that was something that most of us growing up, you know, Ronald Reagan was the person who was telling us to fight against this stuff. And now they've totally let it imbue their whole being.
And there are going to be those people, right? And that's why I think it's so important that the real battle being fought is on digital media. It's on social media right now. And so that's why it's so incumbent on those in this pro-democracy faction that we're building right now that spans from the farthest left to Lincoln Project and everybody in between, those who believe in the core
tenets. Dick Cheney.
Yeah, and Dick Cheney apparently is part of this brand new coalition. Resistance hero Dick Cheney.
Right.
But I think it's incumbent on all of us. Look, there are going to be these people. That's just the reality of today's Republican Party. So it's incumbent on us to continue growing our ecosystem on the left and just defeat these people in election after election so that A, we can continue maintaining our hold on power so that democracy doesn't die, and B, also just hopefully showing the Republican Party that what they're doing right now isn't a viable path toward power. And they can keep espousing these radical far-right views, and that's fine. But if they ever actually want to be a viable political party, they either have to burn it all down and restart from the ashes, or they can keep walking in the wilderness without a majority big enough to actually have power anywhere.
Well, I think that in that case, the latter will probably precipitate the former. But I do want to talk about, you brought something up that actually I'm glad you did, because I want to discuss this with you, which is you are someone who is ubiquitous. Obviously, you have a book out, you have millions of YouTube followers, you are on MSNBC. So there's the easy question, which is probably the harder thing to do, but then the more broad question. So one, how is it that you do all of this stuff? And then secondly, I don't know if you were in Chicago, but there was a lot, there was a story about, I think it was in the Times or maybe several outlets, about how the DNC invited creators into the DNC, gave credentials, gave a place to do it, gave access. And the press was sort of like, well, how come they get to do that and we don't? And I actually had a pretty spirited debate before the convention with Tara Palmieri over at Puck about the idea that as the media, right, you used to be the gatekeeper, that the campaign or a candidate needed you, right, because there was no way to connect with them directly. Trump actually showed us that you didn't need the media. Well, he goes to us anyway, yeah, but he says insane things. So give us a sense of, one, how do you do it all? But secondly, what it means for this creator class, because again, you or Joanne Carducci, JoJo from Jersey, like you guys have millions and millions of people in your audiences, which on any given day is probably a hell of a lot more than the 3 to 4 block on CNN's day side.
Yeah. So to answer your first question, how do I do it with very little sleep and a lot of coffee? And, it's been fine. It's only cost me all of my mental health and meaningful relationships. But other than that, everything.
Welcome to politics.
Just fine.
Yeah, you get used
exactly.
to it.
But, in terms of more broadly, the kind of, I guess, the clash between the mainstream media and creators, look, I think it can be and should be a symbiotic relationship. I couldn't do what I do without the media in terms of sour grapes because of access. I don't really care about that. Look, it's not a zero-sum game. I think my ability to have access to any politicians or any campaigns does not mean more or less access to the mainstream media. I think we can exist in harmony if they want. I think the reason that creators have become more and more important is, and this is to, I guess, to the detriment of mainstream media, is that I think people are tired of the both sides framing that we see so often. I mean, we've gone years and years and years and years, especially in the midst of the Trump administration and the Trump era, where the media really isn't built to take on somebody like Donald Trump. And they constantly confer goodwill to him and his campaign, even though every single time they do, the Trump administration and Trump as the campaign come back and prove that they're not worthy of it or that they were acting in bad faith. And there doesn't seem to be any reckoning among these people in the media in terms of how to cover him properly. And that's what created that opening. If the media was able to cover Donald Trump appropriately, there would be no need for creators. I mean, a lot of, I think, what I do in this space is to just, I mean, it's to give my perspective, but to do so in such a way that doesn't feel some need to equate every little thing that Democrats do, every time they misplace a modifier, with when Republicans commit crimes against humanity and subvert the U.S. Constitution. I know I'm not going to get Republicans to come on my show. The farthest right person I've ever had come on my show, I think, is Tim Miller, which should give you an idea of how far right it goes in terms of who I'm speaking to. But that's okay. Like, I can still do what I do. I can still reach the people I want to reach without having some Republicans spew bad faith talking points. But I think mainstream media is set up in such a way that if they do get too direct with certain members of Congress, certain senators, certain people in the Republican Party, that they lose their access to them. And maybe it's just a fundamental flaw in how mainstream media is structured. I don't know. But I think the fact that we haven't seen some major reckoning in mainstream media is really why we've seen such a meteoric rise from creators.
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of it's also unwatchable. Not when you're on MSNBC, of course.
I appreciate it.
But I mean, you know, I to your point about the equivalency trap that the media falls into, I just remember, was at the beginning of President Biden's administration, I think maybe his daughter or granddaughter got married at the White House, and the press wasn't informed. And they didn't find out until, I think, there were pictures in Vogue or Vanity Fair or something. And they took this as just this massive, you know, this just bed of lies that the Biden administration had perpetrated on them. How could you not tell us? This was a White House event, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. As if, like, okay, yeah, it was a silly mistake. Like, they should have just said, yeah, my granddaughter's getting married. You're going to have one pool photographer. That's it. But, you know, you can't, it's embargoed until the magazine gets here. Like, that, they should have done that. That's fine. But the idea that they were all just aghast, right, at this, when, to your point, you know, Trump didn't hold any real press conferences until COVID. Right.
Well, he also used the White House as a backdrop for the RNC. Talk about right. Not using tax dollars for anything political. The RNC right. was at the White House.
And just let me tell you, when I was in the Bush administration, right, the Hatch Act, which is the law that prevents government employees from being involved in political activity, that was a real thing. You know, if somebody said, you know, if somebody came to you, your White House liaison or and said, be careful with that. That's, you know, that's, you're looking at a Hatch Act violation. Like, people went like, woo, God.
Yeah. Reed, I've had to retape interviews with people because I asked a political, or I wanted to speak about political topics with Democrats. I wanted to speak about political topics. They were in their offices and it was important enough that we had to just scrap it and redo the whole thing so that they were sitting in an office across the street from their congressional office. I mean, they still take it seriously.
Right. But again, that's the thing, is whether or not it's this ability to lie on demand, to divert attention, to create, you know, tension, create violence, impart violence, incite violence, or do things like, you know, utilize the People's House as, you know, your coming out party, your gala convention. It just doesn't matter. And I think that's one thing that I'd like to believe that more individual American citizens care about that as much as I do. I'm not sure they do. But also, as you know, because we are both purveyors of information, there's no shortage also of places people get their news, get their information, get their opinions. And so I think also they just have a harder time parsing it. But I would say that, to your point about what the media is facing and has faced for literally pretty much the last decade, is a lot of their own making, which is, if they were going to give him the benefit of the doubt, they could have given him the benefit of the doubt early. Now they give him the benefit of every doubt, and he deserves none of it. He deserves not one inch of credulity or credibility about any of the things he says. Oh, I'm not involved with Project 2025, but you are, because, you know, Project 47 or whatever they call his next presidential thing is almost word for word, right? These people are going to come and be in his administration. In fact, it would be great if any of our reporter friends are asking is whether or not he will hire any of these Heritage Foundation people to be in his administration if he's elected. My guess is he won't answer the question, but it would be harder for him to get away from Project 2025. And so now let me ask you this. I saw your interview with you, a clip of your interview with Piers Morgan. So I wouldn't really call him right, but how do you deal with a guy like that? Because he's just sort of so ornery anyway.
Look, I think Pierce is always going to pretend that he is some centrist figure, but anybody can hear, if you're acting in good faith, you can hear where he's coming from. You can just listen to the framing of what he says. I've actually come around on this issue because I used to think that it wasn't worth it to platform or to confer some advantage by virtue of going on these platforms, to confer some degree of legitimacy onto them. I've come around now, and I know that if Piers, for example, has spent so long framing his questions in the way he does, that he's of course going to garner something of a right-wing audience. So I'm comfortable enough in our positions, in our agenda, in our stances, that I'm happy to go on there if I think I can make the case and make it to a common sense enough perspective that we can help persuade some people who are listening. That's the whole point of this. I mean, Pete Buttigieg does it really effectively on Fox News. Gavin Newsom did it really effectively in his quasi-debate against both Sean Hannity and Ron DeSantis, which also aired on Fox. So if you have people who I think are effective enough messengers, it's not that the facts aren't on our side, because they are any way you turn it. It's just being able to kind of pierce the right-wing bubble. And what I've always focused on in terms of my own content is just is two things. It's making politics more accessible for regular people, and it's basically pushing back on right-wing disinformation. So I have a lot of experience for years now, just pushing back on these very basic right-wing talking points. And so if I have the opportunity then to go and talk to these people directly and debunk some disinformation directly and kind of take on these purveyors of disinformation, then I'm happy to do it. And I think that more people on the left should, because first of all, the Republicans, to my earlier point, have gotten over their skis and are just, you know, I mean, you don't have to look further than Donald Trump at the debate to know that. But I think if we just push the fact that we're on the right side of whether it's healthcare, whether it's women's reproductive rights, whatever it is, I think that the more we can spread that to people who may not be watching left-wing content specifically, the better off we'll be.
So as the fire hose of BS is coming out, you mentioned the debate. We're now into the third week of Haitians not eating dogs and cats in Ohio. Now you're seeing, you know, the Trump's second assassination attempt is now the fault of Democrats for demonizing Donald Trump, using demonizing language about he's a fascist, he's a threat to democracy, which I hear everywhere now. How do you decide which pile of horse hockey you're going to deal with on any given day?
That's a great question. And that's something that has been kind of plaguing Democrats for a long time. It's like, we are dealing with the fire hose of BS. And so what do we cling on to? Because, you know, Al Franken has this joke where he says that Democrats' bumper sticker ends with "continued on next bumper sticker." And we've always had so much trouble clinging on to one issue. But I think that we can really bat back the daily news cycle stuff. And I think it's important that we do, because remember, when we don't, we're left with death panels from the ACA, for example. If we leave Republicans an opening anywhere, they'll exploit it to the nth degree. And all of a sudden, they'll think that, you know, the ACA, Obamacare, which is now responsible for, you know, tens of millions of people having healthcare in this country, what it was originally branded as by Republicans, because Democrats didn't think it was worth it to deign pushing back on any of this stuff, was that death panels are going to decide whether you live or die. So I think it's important not to leave them openings anywhere. And had we done that with the migrants eating pets thing, people would have believed it, because people don't know any better, you know? And so I think it's always incumbent for Democrats to push back. But then you look at the couple of issues that have been really resonant. One is reproductive rights. And again, I mentioned this earlier, but Republicans have lost elections in Kentucky, Kansas, Ohio, and Alabama. It goes to show just how potent this issue is, left, right, and center in this country. And also just the issue of freedom. You know, this is especially weighty, I think, because this is what a lot of the Republican Party, at least the old school Republican Party, was predicated on. And that is making sure that people, I mean, you mentioned that it was one of the three tenets of the Republican Party, was making sure that you protect individual liberty. Well, now Republicans are stripping away your right to not only reproductive rights, not only IVF, which for many Americans is their only way to build a family, but now they're trying to attack interstate travel. I mean, talk about jumping the shark. This stuff is banana republic level stuff. And people can see that. It's very easy to understand. And so those two things, reproductive rights and freedom more broadly, I think are going to be really resonant in the same way that they've been resonant in midterm elections. And also given their simplicity as a messaging tactic moving forward.
Yeah. And I mean, we should remember that in 2018, Trump gets shellacked. In 2020, he loses the Senate by one. in 2022, we're supposed to have this red wave, red wave, red wave. It's like a red trickle, right? Okay, so yeah, the Republicans take the House, but of course, we've seen now almost 2 years in, they either could not or would not govern themselves. And now we're set up here again. And there was a study out of the Washington Post in the summer of 23 that something, you know, millions of older voters had moved on, you know, into the great beyond, and millions more younger voters have come online since then, right? So that's the other part too, is that, you know, just from a, as a political practitioner, Republicans are running out of old white guys, right? yeah. And they're running out of old white guys all day, every day. But I think that's not for the Democrats, from my perspective, to say, okay, we should go more left, but how do we go scoop up those people? How do we go get those people in rural areas, in the exurbs, right? In those states where like John Tester is fighting for his life. Because, you know, I think Democrats lost like 6, 7, 8 senators from that part of the world over the course of a decade. Really, really hard to get those seats back. But again, to your point, Brian, the Republicans have left that ground available to Democrats. And so what I would say is that the Democrats have a big tent. They need a slightly bigger door to get into it, if that makes sense.
No, it does. And I think that we are facing some systemic barriers in terms of the Senate. And so no matter how many young liberals grow up in this country, no matter how many people who might be more predisposed to voting Democrat move into different states in this country, there are still going to be certain areas and certain states that are just older and whiter and more conservative. And so if we want to be able to take control of the Senate, you can have states like California and New York, you know, get more and more left. It's not going to change the fact that we still do need to hold on to states like Montana. We do need to hold on to states like Ohio, as far as the Senate is concerned. That's how the government works. That's how the U.S. Senate works. And it's and so it's incumbent on us, while at the same time making sure that we continue to benefit from younger voters who are overwhelmingly Democratic, to still make overtures to people who may be in the middle in those other states. I mean, that's just how it works. I would love if it was just one person, one vote in this country. It's not. We have a system with both the Electoral College and the U.S. Senate that are inherently anti-democratic. And so we have to play the hand that we've been dealt, basically. And so we have no choice but to make sure that, to your exact analogy here, we're widening the door for these people to come in.
Before we get to the immediacy of the campaign in the last 6 weeks, I want to ask a question. You got to interview President Joe Biden.
Yeah.
So talk us through like that phone call. Who calls you? How does it get set up? You know, what are you thinking? Like, you see a 202 number on your cell phone, you don't think anything of it. Like, talk us a little bit through how that happened.
No, I actually made my pitch to interview him in the White House, and I had spoken to my contacts in the White House, and I mentioned how, you know, I noticed that the White House had been doing a lot of alternative media content creation, which I noted was excellent, and that's exactly what they should be doing. But at the same time that they're reaching out to Latino singers and artists and actors, all of whom have very important, very gettable audiences that might not be immediately responsive to politics, that at the same time, you know, I'm in here day in, day out in the trenches doing my thing as well. And so they were super receptive to that. And it took 2 or 3 weeks of turnaround before I was sitting in the White House interviewing Joe Biden. But I do remember when they actually said it was happening, that I think the night before I headed to the White House, which would have to be somewhere like February 24th, I believe it was 2022, I can't remember. But the day before the actual interview itself, Russia had invaded Ukraine. And I was like, oh, this is not going to happen. And I was speaking to my cinematographer. We were getting ready. We had packed our bags, packed all of our gear to get on the plane the next morning. And we were coming up with contingency plans and how we would return the gear, you know, thousands of dollars worth of equipment if right. It didn't pan out. And the call never came, and we just got on the plane, and they never said no, and we headed over to the White House, and I remember him walking into the room, and that's when it gets real, and you really do feel like you're in the center of the universe when the President of the United States walks in.
Yeah, you know, as the audience has heard me say for years, being an old advanced man, right? I was all over the country and all over the world with President George W. Bush, and it could be in a palace in St. Petersburg, or it could be in a hallway in an elementary school in Ohio. And the motorcade pulls up, you hop out of the lead car, that was the car I rode in, and you see everybody standing there, they're sort of joking, and then the president comes in, and it's a whole other thing.
Yeah.
It's this combination of like energy, simultaneously with the air being sucked out of the room, right? And the president appears. And of course, there's all the attendant activity, right? There's the Secret Service and there's the staff and there's the mill-aid and all this stuff. And there's all this activity. And then, you know, they work their way down the line. And I always remember that the first question George Bush asked of the first person he spoke to was, were my people polite? Were they okay to work with? Did they give you any trouble? And you had better hope that whoever he asked first liked you, because you did not want to be on the receiving end, as I was several times, of him looking at you and saying, what was going on out here while I wasn't here? Why am I worrying about this? I'm the president of the United States. But that must have been pretty cool.
It was. And I think for as exciting a moment it is when the president walks in, what really highlights the degree to which you're in the center of the universe is when he leaves and you are just left in this vacuum of energy and everything is so quiet. And you're like, ah, well, that really puts in stark contrast the moment that you were just in and how quiet things are after that. And you just feel like it kind of feels like what I would imagine once the tornado keeps moving beyond you and you're just left in its wake and it's just still and quiet.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you, it's interesting you say that, because we used to call it the adrenaline dump, which was when Air Force One took off, right? And all presidents have their own codenames, but it was all cars, all stations, Trailblazer, depart. And as soon as the tire left the tarmac, like, that was the call you got from the White House Communications Agency. And then all of it from like your head to your feet just drained out of you. And it was just like you were just this mess, because for 6 days you've been on and on and on. But all right, so let's talk about the next 6 weeks. What are you looking at? What are you worried about? What's encouraging to you? What are you going to be focused on here as this race finally comes to a head?
What am I worried about? How much time you got? I'm worried about
everything. Well, I got all the time you got, so.
Yeah. I'm worried. Look, between being a Democrat, working in politics, and being Jewish, I'm worried about literally everything. I'm like predisposed to every anxiety in the world here.
Sure.
I think what I'm most focused on is just continuing to make the case, knowing full well that these last few weeks, look, I do political content every day, 7 days a week, way too many hours a day, and that's all year round. And even still, I know that in the next 6 weeks, there are going to be so many more people watching than have ever watched before. And so for as kind of repetitive as it feels for me to have to go through this stuff on a daily basis, I just have to tell myself that I'm not just reaching the same faction of people that I'm used to reaching. Now, people are going to be tuning in every day. People who don't even know who's running in this race. People who couldn't tell you anything about politics. And so I just have to keep my eye on the ball, as I think everybody in the progressive media ecosystem or left of center media ecosystem has to do. Keep our eye on the ball and know that every day is another opportunity to persuade new people who wouldn't otherwise have been tuning in, because the vast majority of Americans don't pay attention to this stuff. And we have to know, even though we can't see the people on the other end of our phones or our computers or our TVs, that exponentially more people are tuning in who have no idea, for whom all of this stuff is a complete blank canvas. And so, you know, that kind of stuff helps me in terms of just knowing that I have to keep my head down, keep hammering away at the reproductive rights stuff, at the attacks on freedom stuff, doing it even though it might feel redundant or repetitive to me, that I'm actually going to be able to reach people who I wouldn't have been able to reach a week ago, a month ago, or a year ago.
Yeah. And I think, look, repetition in politics, it can get boring. I get it, but it works, right? There's a reason why we do it. There's a reason why you'll see the same ad 8,000 times.
And by the way, why Donald Trump's build the wall, lock her up, make America great again, all of that stuff works. It's because he's seared it into the cerebral cortexes of all of his supporters.
Yeah. And to your point, when you come face to face with a full-blooded, full-throated Trump supporter, for someone who's gone full MAGA, at least in this moment, Brian, there's no coming back, at least not before Election Day. Now, after Election Day, after Trump is lost and they're sort of figuring out where they're going to go, maybe we can start to claw some of them back. But they are as deep in it as probably some of them have ever been. And I would say the other part about talking about, you know, freedom and reproductive rights and the issues that are, you know, important to you and to the people that you speak to is also never letting off the pedal on Trump, right? Never, ever, ever giving him, to your point, any free air. And I think that's one thing, too, that, you know, in 2016, I think if you looked back at the amount of airtime, the amount of media time that Trump got versus Hillary Clinton, right, it wasn't even close. But I think that's one thing that drove Trump as crazy as anything is how much attention that Vice President Harris and Governor Waltz were getting, right, in that first 4 or 5 weeks they were in, and that it's still pretty much at parity. And I think that's a part of the other thing, too, that you're seeing with his insanity is all coming to a head, which is he feels like he's losing. He knows he lost the debate. He's not getting the positive attention he wants. I mean, the vice president's, you know, just stiletto into his ego with the crowds leaving. And now, of course, every time there's a rally, there's a picture of crowds leaving, right? I think that's one thing, too, with Democrats is like you have to finish them politically, of course. You have to make sure that you don't give them any space to try and find something else. Look, we've already seen it in Georgia. The state senator in Nebraska, right, just saved that electoral vote probably for Vice President Harris. And so, you know, we should not forget, and as I said this last week, too, is this election for me is coming down to two phases between now and when polls close and when the polls close to January 20th. And that's how 2020 was, too. Like, we knew something bad was going to happen. We didn't know it would be January 6th, but we should not be under no illusion whatsoever that there are people out there. And look, in many cases, Brian, they're doing it out in the open now, right? Saying, how are we going to make sure that we don't even necessarily want to steal it for Donald Trump? We just want to make it so hard for anybody to figure out, well, who'd really won? How can you trust any of this stuff? And that's why I think, look, our elections have been free. Our elections are fair. They will be fair. The people who were committing election fraud in the past have typically been Trump supporters, right? They have not been Democrats. They have not been undocumented immigrants. I mean, think about, Brian, just from a rational perspective, how many undocumented immigrants want to go to a county building and fill out an official form that they know is a felony? Like, that's just not at the top right, of their
just
list.
Just dying to get themselves deported.
Right.
They go through all of the trouble of getting into the United States. And the first thing they want to do is put themselves in front of the authorities. It's just airtight logic.
Well, listen, you have given me a lot of your time today, and I want to say thank you. Before we let you go, I know that many of my listeners are probably also many of your viewers, but before we let you go, where can everybody find you on social media, on YouTube, any place else that we need to hear the good word?
So I'm on every platform, too many platforms, but I'm on Brian Tyler Cohen, just at Brian Tyler Cohen on YouTube, Facebook, Snapchat, TikTok, Instagram, the whole gamut there. And again, as you very kindly noted, the book is called Shameless, Republicans' Deliberate Dysfunction and the Battle to Preserve Democracy. You can get that anywhere books are sold. And yeah, Reed, thank you so much for all of your time. I appreciate it.
As always, gang, you can find me over at Substack, also the home front. You can find me on Twitter and TikTok. At Reed Galen on Threads and Instagram at Reed_GalenUSA. And go to jointheunion.us, guys. We are going to North Carolina this weekend. We are going to be in Raleigh Friday evening, Saturday afternoon, Sunday on the Duke campus. Come out and join us. Go to jointheunion.us for all the information. Brian Tyler Cohen, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Reed.
And everybody else, we'll see you next time.